Hi, I'm Katie.
And I'm Chris. And this is the EdShift Podcast.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to this episode of the EdShift Podcast. Really excited to be joined here today by Austin Roy. But before we dive into that, I want to give a little bit of a content warning for today's episode. You might have noticed in the episode title that we're talking about death education. So that means that today we're going to be talking about topics like, of course, death, the process of dying, grieving, and a few things related to that. So if that's something that feels sensitive or like maybe today is not the right day for you to listen to a conversation about that, would love for you to put this episode aside and come back later when it feels like a better time. Otherwise, super thrilled to welcome Austin Roy to the podcast. Austin is an English teacher at Flint Ridge Preparatory School in LA, where he teaches 10th grade American literature, as well as 12th grade course on Joan Didion. Love it. He's also an adjunct professor of market research and data analytics at the University of Southern California. He's worked in bioethics at the Huntington Hospital and hospice care through the No One Dies Alone program at UCSF Hospital. He currently lectures about and guides workshops on death education, and we are super happy to have him here with us. Welcome to the podcast, Austin.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to talk.
So let's jump right in and start by unpacking what we mean when we say death education. What even is that?
Yeah, I think it's a great question, one that a lot of people have. For me, I think about death education as really having two parts. The first part has to do with grieving and all of the emotional aspects of death, the mental health aspects of death. And then the other part for me are the logistics of death and the logistical complexities of both death, the dying process, going through it with someone else, the mourning process, and all that that entails.
Yeah, that's a lot of stuff that everyone is going to deal with at some point in their lives that we get zero information about in our formal education, which is kind of wild when you think about it. You know, we are frequently ill-equipped to deal with death and often nervous and scared to talk about it, especially with young people. So how did you come to thinking about this and advocating for the importance of death education?
I think you said it really well, that death and dying are some of the most emotional but also complex things we will ever face in our lives. And we are supposed to address them without any sort of preparation or formal training. And to me, that is a massive failure of our education systems, since the whole purpose of our education system is to prepare people to lead fulfilling and meaningful and full lives. So the way that I came into death education was a little bit circuitous, honestly. When I was about 14 years old, I started teaching a dance class for people with Parkinson's disease. And I started becoming really close friends with a lot of much older people who had a terminal illness. And eventually, of course, they started getting sicker and dying. And I was completely inequipped to deal with this. And I remember when I was 16 years old, towards the end of my 10th grade year of high school, I read Joan Didion's book, The Year of Magical Thinking, and that book changed my life. As you mentioned, I now teach a course on Joan Didion, so it's probably evident, but it not only did it, you know, provide me with language that I had never seen before, and she used words in a way that I don't think any author, at least any author that I had read at the time, had used words, but she was able to, you know, in a way, show and write what I was feeling. And that was something really incredible. And so she was kind of my entry point into the world of grief and mourning and death. And from there, I really dove in, which manifested in college as an undergraduate. I double majored in cognitive science and philosophy. And the amazing overlap there is bioethics. And I joined the bioethics team at Huntington Hospital and again, spend a lot of time with very, very sick and dying people asking really large ethical questions. And being in that environment really solidified the fact that I found death education to be something we need to be teaching specifically to young people.
Yeah, that's so interesting. I had almost an opposite experience to you when I was growing up, in that I my father had cystic fibrosis, terminal illness. So the fact that he was, you know, probably not going to be around for a long time was something that was a very present part of my life. And I, you know, also knew many people that also had CF, or were waiting for lung transplants that, you know, that we lost along the way. I was incredibly lucky that my dad, did receive a lung transplant and, you know, lived, 26 years post-transplant, until his fairly recent passing. But I remember, you know, as, you know, you said 14, you know, I remember as a 14-year-old thinking, like seeing other friends experience, you know, the death of a grandparent or something like that, and being like, oh, this is new for people. So when we think about how this could look in schools or things that you've seen been successful, Austin, what would great look like to you?
What a great question. I love that question. In an ideal world, I think that high schools are reconfigured a little bit. High schools are reconfigured to include more classes that prepare students for life rather than life lived within the ivory tower. You know, we're teaching students, I think, how to be academics, which is so important, obviously. I am a teacher. I consider myself a scholar and an academic. That being said, I think it is bonkers that we are saying, you've become an adult and you've graduated high school, but you don't know how to do your taxes, how to get healthcare, how to change a tire, or how to fill out these really basic forms that a doctor will give you at a hospital if your mom is dying. But you know how to do calculus, which again, I think is really important. So in this great world, in this, you know, utopic high school, I would say that there is a full life prep course that is maybe a year long for seniors, where students are walked through some of these topics by professionals, by their teachers, in, you know, an emotion sensitive environment. Things like death education, things like financial literacy, things like healthcare literacy, so that we can walk through those complex things like NDAs and DNRs and pulse forms, so that when they get to a hospital, they're able to say, I've seen this before because it was something that came to me in high school. So to me, that is the ideal world, that we have an actual death education course that is a prerequisite for graduation, or a requisite for graduation. That being said, I don't really think that's something a lot of schools are ready to jump into at this moment. And so what I think is much more likely is doing what I do, for example, at my high school, which is very progressive. Love the school a whole lot. But it's something that I weave into my current curriculum. So I'm an English teacher. I teach a class on Joan Didion, and I happen to weave in a few weeks of death education, which I also think hope is very meaningful.
What's really interesting to me, as you talk about like the need for death education, which I completely agree with, is the fact that we also need to help kids, I think, understand some of the emotional aspects too. Like there's the very, you know, form-based, all of the things that we need to do and being aware of that. And then I think one of the gaps that I've seen, so thinking back to, you know, when I was in the classroom in high school, our kids are confronted with death more often than I think we really think about when we're thinking about big picture of like what's happening in kids' worlds. I'm thinking of your story, you know, Katie, and what you kind of processed growing up, and particularly some of our more at-risk students, right? They see a higher proportion of loss in their communities for a whole slew of reasons that we won't even get into here. And I think like one of those challenges is A, what do they do personally? How do they support their friends when there's a loss there? Like, I think this whole idea of processing loss and this almost paralyzing fear that comes with it, like, what do I do? What do I say? And we get to this decision paralysis where we don't do anything because we don't know what to do. And we have a strong cultural desire to be respectful and to give people privacy and all of these phrases that we use. So I'm really curious, particularly maybe even in the context of your Joan Didion class, like, do you dive into the emotions of it? Like, do you talk with kids about processing that? And how do you do that? And
Could you give some tips for other teachers out there who might think of ways to incorporate this into some of their classes?
Absolutely. Again, a great question. We dive into it a lot. And thankfully, Joan Didion has given us a perfect framework for which to do that, in the sense that she has a few sections in this book. For anyone who hasn't read the book, it's called The Year of Magical Thinking, and it's about the year after her husband's very sudden death. He died of a heart attack at the dinner table, and she wrote this book about the year afterwards and her grief in that year afterwards. And in the book, she talks about how her friends try to console her, who are all very well-intentioned, but she very clearly and succinctly says that some do a better job than others. And her friend who does the best job doesn't really talk to her very much, but he brings her soup every single day without her asking for it. And that is what she needed. And I can tell you, that is not what I would need. That is not at all what I would need. I need someone to be with me every second of every day asking me how I'm doing. And so I always share that with students just to say and to clearly elucidate, you know, people grieve differently and people need different things. And so I think when it comes to giving tips to students, I think this is an excellent opportunity. I don't love this phrase, but to role play. I think of it in the way that we also teach sex education. Part of our sex ed at our school, at least, has students role play saying no in different ways to say no, whether it's to sex or to drugs or to alcohol, just because I think we give this message to students saying, just say no.
Like that's easy.
That's the hardest thing in the whole world. But if you're given a list of 30 different ways to say no, and you're going to practice some of them, it might be like silly in moments, but it's actually really helpful. And so we do that also with grieving about like, what are 30 ways? We just brainstorm as a class. What are 30 ways that you could console someone? And let's imagine that you are in this situation. What would you want? And of course, what students come to very quickly is, let's start with communication. You know, I want someone to ask me what I need. And maybe in moments, guess what I need. For example, Joan Didion didn't say she needed soup, but it is what she needed. But start first with open communication. But it's really helpful to brainstorm those moments with students so that, again, when they are in those situations, they hopefully have this toolbox of 30 approaches.
Do you think there's space for this in students younger than high school? Like, we're always talking about protecting our kids, and yet the world is hard. Like, is there a version of this that you see maybe with our middle schoolers, maybe even with our elementary kids? Like,
start them young is my answer. I think it's so comical that we have this idea of protect our kids, and protecting by omission seems like a horrible way of protecting a child. You know, think of that child who very sadly loses a parent at age 7 or 8 or 9 or 10. Are you protecting them by not preparing them for that moment? Or are you making it a whole lot worse for them? I believe it's way better to prepare. That being said, do I think it's appropriate or developmentally correct to be teaching a 6-year-old about how to fill out an advance directive? No, I don't. And so I think it's, you know, we're educators and we understand that you have to tailor information to a specific age range. So, you know, in those young years, it's probably reading storybooks about characters who experience death or who are near death, which is, you know, abundant in fairy tales. And then just having conversations with a student. How do you think that person feels? How do you think, you know, the character's friends might be able to console them? And then working your way up through, you know, elementary school and middle school ages to having more in-depth conversations, which might culminate in, you know, those upper grade levels, 11th, 12th, with actually understanding, here are the forms you might fill out at a hospital.
I like that you mentioned, even just in your language there, the idea of being like near death, and I'm air quoting that, because I think so often when we talk about death, it's black and white. You're live, you're alive, or you're not alive. But there is, you know, you mentioned the word process, right? Like dying is a, you know, obviously there's times when this isn't necessarily the case, but often it's a process. There's things that happen in between, you know, sitting here living today and you know, not, that it's not just black and white. So I think the idea of that process and that idea of perhaps being near death is something that, that, again, we probably don't talk about enough. And is there any sort of specific resources, or how much, you know, detail do you think is appropriate when we're talking about education and looking at that nearby or that process conversation?
I mean, I talk about all of this in my class. I think covering the death and dying process in great depth is really important. Again, just A, because, you know, dying shouldn't, in my opinion, be a scary word, and we should be able to talk about it freely. But also because, again, it is a process, and this is something that they will encounter. And so just preparing them for the moment of death, I think, is, again, doing students a disservice. We need to explain to them what that looks like. Obviously, it's different for everyone. As someone who's worked in hospitals for many years, I've seen one very specific type of dying, which is usually a prolonged process. But obviously, there is instant death, which is, I think, very different. But I think explaining that to students and walking them through what it can look like step by step is very important. And I talk with my students about that, about, you know, I've been with people weeks before they die, hours before they die, and while they are dying from being alive to dead. I've been there, you know, several times. And it's different. It's different for every single person. And it's different depending on the stage they're in.
And I think that's so important because, you know, we're afraid of the things we don't understand. And death falls in that category because we don't talk about it enough. And so, like, I'm actually really excited for the opportunity your kids have to hear those stories and to ask some of those questions. And I think one of the other things I wonder about is, you know, we have choice when it comes to this process as well. And so is that something that you find kids are curious about? You know, I lost my mom to cancer, and there was a lot of decisions that she actually had control to make, and was able to kind of make them on her terms. And I don't think everyone always realizes that, again, because we're not talking about it enough. So what are the questions your students ask, and what are some of the conversations that you've had that have really helped make this less unknown and frightening to them?
I think the main questions that come up are often tied to patient autonomy, and specifically when that autonomy, the right word, disappears, really. And the ways in which I approach that are talking really about two, in my opinion, very important but very separate things. The first one is physician aid in dying, and the second one is the advanced directive. So starting with physician aid in dying, allows for people to die with dignity, essentially, and if they do not want to suffer and are terminally ill, they have the option to end their life in the care of a physician in a non-harmful or embarrassing way. To me, this is a no-brainer. It really is. I have no idea why we would force someone to undergo torture and then die when they do not want to. That being said, it is incredibly controversial. It is not approved in many states. It is in California, where I am right now. Even where it is approved, there are several restrictions. And I understand these restrictions. I was actually with the Huntington Hospital Bioethics Committee when they were making their policy around this. And there are really a few restrictions to keep in mind. Number one, you have to be 18 years older. And I'll talk specifically right now about the California aid in dying requirements. So you have to be 18 years or older and a resident of California. You have to have a terminal disease that cannot be cured or reversed and that is expected to result in death within 6 months. This might sound straightforward, but is incredibly rare. It is incredibly rare. Essentially, these aid in dying laws were created specifically for terminally ill cancer patients and were created by people in the cancer community. And I think they have done an incredible service. They've done something that's helped so many people. That being said, I think it's really narrow right now, and I would love to see that broadened. Number three, they have to have capacity to make medical decisions and not have impaired judgment due to a mental disorder. And number four, they have to have the physical ability to ingest the drug. I have talked about this a lot with people at Huntington Hospital. What does physical ability mean? You're required to drink. And so there was a patient who was paralyzed from the neck down and could not lift the straw to their lips. And did it count if someone brought the glass forward and put a straw in it for them? And that did not count. So they were not able to take advantage of Aiden dying. And again, to me, these requirements, some of them, specifically the second and the fourth, are very narrow and restrictive, and I would love to see them broadened.
I would argue that that's why we need to talk to our kids about this more, because these are decisions they'll make when they become adults, right? Like, these are things that we vote on in our different states. And I think being able to talk about it, being able to process it, being able to sit with it as they mature and fully develop their identities and all of that stuff that happens to teenagers, I think that's really key in us getting to a place where we start to really think about what these laws were designed to do. Because again, going back to the things that we don't understand are the things that we're afraid of and the things that we're sometimes subject to misinformation on. But imagine if every kid had a better, well-grounded, non-politicized approach to this, where would we go and what could we do? And so that, I just think it's really important, and it's amazing that you're taking the time to do that with them. So you mentioned a little bit too about advanced directives, and I think that's another key thing. Like,
I'll start by saying none of my high school students so far have ever heard of advanced directive, let alone, you know, none of them have them. And most Americans have not completed their advanced directives. So it's incredibly important. And for anyone listening who doesn't know, an advanced directive is a form that lets family and doctors know how you wish to be treated if you get very sick and are unable to communicate with them. So just going into it a little bit, there are a lot of different versions of the form, and it varies state by state. But looking at the California one, for example, there are really two key parts. The first one is the medical power of attorney. And this allows you to designate a primary decision maker for your healthcare decisions if you're unable to make decisions yourself. And the second thing is the healthcare decision section. And this allows you to explain exactly what type of decisions you would like to be made regarding your healthcare. And it asks some very specific questions. You know, would you ever want to be put on a ventilator? To what extent would you like or not like life-saving treatment? And then, which I always tell students, there is an open comment section at the very bottom, and you can write anything you want. And you can bet that I have filled that in with a full page of requests for everything that I want. And so going back to the student piece, I walk through this with students, and it is not a requirement for students to fill this out for my class. I think that'd be inappropriate, but every single one does. And they all go home and make sure that their parents have filled them out too.
I think it's just something we don't talk about. Like, whenever have you talked to anyone like outside of work about any of these things? Like, it doesn't come up, and I don't know. I'd like it to happen more often.
You know, the quick story about how I, again, became truly obsessed with this form, the advanced directive, is that I joined the Huntington Hospital bioethics community when I was a grad student at USC. The first thing that they do is that they review any bioethical issues that have happened over the past month. And so there are these monthly scheduled meetings where everyone meets together. And then there are these ad hoc meetings. And if there is ever a bioethical dilemma at the hospital, you will get an email from the head of bioethics, who is Dr. Wendy Kohlhase, who is, you know, a phenomenal bioethicist. And she will ask for volunteers from all three of these sectors to convene immediately at the hospital. And the first time, I will never forget, the first time I got one of those requests for an ad hoc meeting, I immediately said yes. I canceled work for the day. I canceled my classes. I took this like 2-hour metro from USC to Huntington Hospital. And I got briefed on the case. And it was a case of this man who had gone through 52 units of blood in, I believe, a 48-hour period, which is far too much. Far too much. His body was clearly shutting down. He was also experiencing multiple organ failure, which is a precursor to death. And his family was there. And he had two daughters who were both in their 40s, and one daughter had their two grandchildren. And they were asking the hospital for dialysis. And the doctors were saying, we are unwilling to perform dialysis because it would cause undue harm to this person's body, and it would be medically ineffective, and we're not willing to perform it. And so that is where we were starting this meeting. After getting briefed, I met with the family, and it was, you know, one of the most charged hours of my life. And I stayed very quiet just because I didn't know, you know, I still don't know as much, obviously, as a bioethicist or a doctor. But it was really incredibly difficult. And I think the approach that we were trying to take from the bioethics side was we were approaching this from a logos perspective or an ethos perspective about why this was, again, medically ineffective, would cause undue harm. And they really wanted to proceed with dialysis and were, really sticking to their viewpoints. And it was about an hour in that the young grandson, who's about 18 years old, finally piped up and said, you know, grandpa wouldn't have wanted this. He never wanted to suffer. He didn't want his life prolonged in this way. He definitely never wanted to be on a ventilator. And that was all the daughters needed to hear. And they were like, you're right. He did say that. And within minutes, they were agreeing to hospice. And they said, can we please have 24 hours before starting hospice? And we said, yes. And about 10 hours later, he died. And so we didn't even, like, it all in the end was unnecessary. But it was, and I mean, I was 20 at the time. I was super young and it was awful. I then took a week off of work. I was super traumatized. And it made me think that, and I remember the head of bioethics, Wendy, saying to me, Dr. Colhay, saying, none of this would have been necessary if the patient had filled out an advance directive. And I say this in almost every single one of my cases. And I then looked into the advance directive and I realized she was completely, of course, completely right. And that you would never have to go through one of those situations or put your family through one of those situations if we all just filled out advance directives. And if we were taught about that in school.
For me, it kind of hits on one of the key points of why death education is so valuable, because the story you just told, right? I mean, it's a family grappling with the emotions of losing someone and trying to make decisions when they have all these like big and strong and complicated emotions, and they're trying to do what's best, probably in a slightly incapacitated state, because that's just how our brains work. Think about things like wills, like how do things in your life get distributed? Like, how do you do this to unburden the people you're leaving behind, to give them all the space they need for the grief that's going to overcome them, as opposed to having all these decisions that have to happen in that window of grieving, which is a messy place. And so I think that's where this concept of death education and the idea that we could, as humans, be more comfortable talking about it and better prepared for it to make it less traumatic. Because I think the fear and the trauma probably feed each other in some way.
To build really quickly off of what you were saying, this is not something I teach at all, but I think it's also really important. You were mentioning, you know, all of the logistical things you have to deal with after someone dies, which is something I have very, very little experience with. But I was talking with a friend recently about, if I was to leave my job, which I would never do because I love being an English teacher more than life itself. If I were to leave my job, though, I would absolutely start a startup where they're essentially like wedding planners, but for death, and someone just to coordinate between getting several death certificates, you know, dealing with the will, selling of clothes and furniture, dealing with funeral arrangements. There are so many annoying logistics you have to deal with.
I'm curious where the ideas or conversation about spirituality do or don't come into play. I might believe that something specific happens to a soul after death, and the person sitting across from me might not believe that there even is a soul that anything needs to happen to after death. How do you navigate that part of these conversations?
It's funny, it's never been part of my course, but now, especially in the last year, I've been giving various lectures and workshops, and I've just been more in this like death circuit. And it's a question that's come up a lot. And when we get to that point in my senior class, which will be coming up in about 3 months, I have actually included another assignment where each of my students will research a different culture and how they approach the death and dying process from a lot of various aspects, one of them being a spiritual one, just because I think understanding how different religious communities and spiritual communities address death and dying is fascinating.
I love your idea of having your students go and kind of look at this from all angles and look at, because then it becomes less about, you know, what do you believe versus what do I believe? And are those things different versus like, what historically have people believed? What do people that aren't sitting in this room believe? I think there's such an interesting opportunity to look at it from those different angles.
And then I think kids get to see things and maybe find things that resonate with them, right? Like their high schoolers are in that period where they're trying things on, they're seeing what fits, they're building their identities. And like, what a great time to start to pull in all of these different pieces, because particularly, you know, if you don't come from a background or family where those things have been talked about, or where there's traditions or history, to know that you have all of these choices you could make, I feel like that's probably a little bit empowering, even if it's not something you're explicitly diving into in the classroom.
I love that. Well, I think that we could probably just keep talking about this for a really long time. But this was such a great conversation, Austin. Is there anything that you would leave, you know, advice or takeaways, you know, for a classroom teacher or, you know, an educator of any stripe who's listening to this?
I'll give two pieces of advice. And one has nothing to do with being a teacher or educator, but I feel very compelled to say it. It is how I end every single thing I do with deaf education. You both definitely heard this. I lecture at South by Southwest. Fill out an advanced directive right now. If you're listening to this podcast, do it today. You can complete it in 10 minutes. It's very short. You can spend a lot longer on it if you want to, but it could drastically alter the course of your life, and you deserve that. That's the first piece of advice. The second piece of advice that will be more tailored to educators is consider finding a way of incorporating deaf education into your curriculum. Again, it can have, as we've been discussing, a really huge impact on the lives of your students. And it doesn't have to mean A, that you are an expert in deaf education in any way, or B, that you have a course on life prep or deaf education, or even someone like Joan Didion who writes about deaf. I think it'd be really easy to incorporate some of these things into an English class if you have characters who are experiencing death or grief or dying, into advisory when you're talking about how to support your friends and family members through tough times, in a history class when you're talking about, you know, the death and dying rituals of the ancient Egyptians and the Book of the Dead. There are so many different entry points for this. And so I would say, look for that tangential connection and make it happen. That's what we do best as teachers, right?
Great pieces of advice. Austin, thank you so much for being here. Thank you so much for this conversation. I'm taking away a lot. I know that our listeners are going to take away a lot. We will have some show notes, friends, for where you can find Austin, where you can find some resources or more information about a few of the things that we talked about. And yeah, thank you for being here on the EdShift podcast, and we'll talk to you next time.